Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Kevin Williamson of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual. And, Kevin, we start with the good, which could potentially be good news for conservatives if they can make this part of the Hillary Clinton narrative. It becomes clearer and clearer every day that she's already launching her 2016 presidential bid. But some of the Hillary Clinton papers are out, specifically from her time as First Lady. And we're learning things that don't exactly shock us, but it might not be all that great to be out there for public dissemination during a presidential campaign. For example, she's recently said she was never in favor of single payer. These papers suggest that when it came to health care reform, which she was intimately involved with that effort in the early part of the Bill Clinton administration, she absolutely wanted single payer. When her husband was thinking about intervening in the genocide in Bosnia, she said these people have been fighting each other for 900 years. What's the big deal? She essentially, I don't know if she necessarily excused her husband's behavior with Monica Lewinsky, but basically blamed it on the fact that they'd been through a lot of personal incidents already in the term with her dad and his mom and both passing away and the Vince Foster situation. So it was at least understandable. First of all, do you think this is going to make any difference all these years later? And secondly, what do you make of what we've learned here?
I don't think it'll make any difference simply because voters don't care about facts, history, competence, anything like that. I mean, if they did, Hillary Clinton would be an unknown figure because she's actually never done anything in her life to justify her place in American society. I mean, in a sane world, Hillary Clinton would be a hate figure among feminists because the only reason anyone knows her name is because she was married to a powerful man and stayed married to him through thick and thin, better for worse, which turned out to be a lot of worse. And her career as a lawyer was unimpressive. And basically everything she's done since then was, in tribute to her powerful and very successful and very talented husband. So in a world in which voters had the ability to analyze fairly simple and straightforward of issues, she would have been dead in the water back in the days of the cattle futures question, which was clearly, crooked. And I don't think there's any defending that particular transaction. But that was one little thing in a long history of questionable decisions and doings. Her record as Secretary of State should be in and of itself disqualifying for her as a presidential candidate because she was incompetent. She's a very bright woman and a woman with some skills and talents in life, but she has been put into positions that far outmatch them. She was a mediocre, if that, senator. She's a catastrophic Secretary of State. And so, yeah, she's got a great chance of being elected president, I think.
Well, one of the things that Jim and I have talked about, and I firmly hold to this, is that I think most of the mainstream media feels guilty about what they did to her in 2008 by basically kicking her to the curb because they became enamored with Barack Obama, and there's pretty much no chance they're willing to do that again. So how much of a free ride is she going to get, and do you think that analysis is pretty much right?
I think the first half of it's right. Yeah, they maybe feel a little guilty about throwing her over, kind of like her husband did as a practical matter. But for something younger and more interesting. I don't think that precludes them finding another enthusiasm in 2016. I mean, the thing about Hillary that conservatives ought to keep in mind is that it could be much worse. You know, we could be looking at President Elizabeth Warren. We could be looking at, a figure of similar contemptibility. Here at National Review, we had this discussion a lot, that between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama back during the primary, we thought she was a vastly preferable candidate, arguably as left-wing as him, but enough of a sensible figure to moderate those instincts to an extent. So, yeah, I mean, don't get too excited about it if she implodes, because we could certainly do worse and probably will.
All right, on to the second martini, the bad news now. And Republicans and conservatives were up in arms, and some people who just care about the Constitution, who don't necessarily have much of a political bent, were up in arms late last year when Harry Reid decided that, darn it, these filibuster rules just aren't cutting it for us. Republicans are stopping votes on some of the president's more radical nominees. So he essentially changed it to a simple majority to get a lot of these different nominees confirmed. But now he's getting more pressure from labor unions and others that there's still too much gridlock in Washington. And the Hill newspaper reporting that Reid is reluctant to do it because he knows what kind of backlash he's going to get, particularly in an election year. But he's kicking it around nonetheless because he's still not getting a whole lot of work actually done, either to the president's liking or at all. What do you make of Reid going down this path once again, possibly?
Well, I mean, surprise, surprise. I mean, these are not decisions made out of principle. The thing that really bothers me about this whole discussion is that complaining that the Senate is obstructing the president is like complaining that water is wet. I mean, if you've ever read our Constitution or the Federalist Papers or much of the discussion of our founding institutions, the Senate is there to obstruct. That's its job. Senate is there to put a brake on the House, which is the more democratic institution and therefore the less stable, and also to put a brake on the presidency, which when you invest that much power in a single man, you have to have strong constitutional controls on that office. So, you know, people complain about gridlock in the Senate, and it's a sign of ignorance, I think. I'm not one of these people who always prefers gridlock for its own sake. There's a lot of things I'd like to change about our legal institutions and our political practices. But that is kind of what the Senate is there to do. And if Reid's legacy ultimately is making the Senate into just a super powerful version of the House of Representatives, then he will have done a great deal of violence to our constitutional arrangements. And I think that's going to be a terrible thing for us in the long run. So, you know, I like separation of powers and checks and balances and all that kind of stuff. So the less, you know, responsive the Senate is, the better, in my view.
Quick follow-up. When Reid did move forward on some of these filibuster changes last year, there was kind of a debate on the right about if the Republicans can win back the Senate majority here in 2014, do you leave the current rules in place and try to roll back some of the damage, or do you go back to where the rules were in order to keep the system or return the system to where it might be better in a more checks and balance type of way, like you were just describing? What do you prefer?
Well, the principal thing to do would be to reinstate the previous rules, I think, which means that almost certainly Republicans won't do that.
All right, let's move on to martini number three now, the crazy martini. And, of course, last week, a lot of the chatter here in Washington was about the Congressional Budget Office report on Obamacare and the news that by 2024, there would be about 2.5 million fewer jobs out there, some of it due to employers not wanting to have a certain number of employees so they didn't have to comply with Obamacare, others cutting back hours so they didn't have to comply with it as much. Republicans saw this as the smoking gun, the final nail in the coffin, whatever metaphor you want to use. Democrats saying, no. This provides people with much more flexibility. The latest incarnation of this was on ABC's This Week. Here's Minnesota Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison.
What the Congressional Budget Office is saying is that we're going to discourage kids having to have latchkey. We're going to have parents being able to come home working reasonable hours. People are going to be able to retire. People might be able to actually cook dinner rather than have to order out and get some takeout. I mean, the fact is that if Americans could have more choices to open up a new business they've been wanting to start, this is a good thing. You know, if you look at comparisons country by country, Americans work way more than the average of industrialized countries around the world.
Kevin, I think most moms and dads would like to be home, but I think they'd also like jobs.
Yeah, okay, well, Muppet newsflash. Keith Ellison is an economically illiterate person who should be kept far away from the levers of power to the extent that that's possible. What's really dumb about this discussion is all the people saying, oh, no, these aren't lost jobs. These are workers voluntarily choosing to cut back their hours, which is exactly the same thing. There are two sides to every transaction. Employment has a supply side and a demand side. Workers are the supply side, and if they decide they don't want to supply at the wage on offer, which is the important part of the discussion here that no one ever talks about, then you've eliminated jobs, the same as you would if employers were cutting back. So it's not as the workers can't eliminate jobs in the same way that employers do. I mean, it's just illiterate to say otherwise. What's lost in this is the question of at what wage. So what Obamacare does, of course, is it makes unemployment financially more attractive, and it also puts downward pressure on wages, particularly for low-skilled workers, because it becomes more expensive to hire them as full-time employees, and so that generally comes out of wages. So they're making the perfectly rational calculation that they're better off not working than they are working. And in many cases, that's probably true. I mean, if the question is we don't want to have a policy that causes people to be locked into jobs where they're not well used and well compensated simply because they need access to a health insurance program. Well, the first item on the Republicans' health care reform list is portability, not having your health care locked to your employer. I don't think anyone really objects to that particular change. Most people think that would be a good thing. You can have that without having this, you know, multi-trillion dollar fiasco known as the Affordable Care Act. So it's you know, it's happy talk on the part of Democrats. The fact is that whether someone has to work or someone doesn't have to work, ultimately someone has to do the work. You know, money floating around doesn't grow food or build houses or build cars or develop prescription drugs or anything like that. I mean, labor has actual physical meaningful output other than the paycheck that people get. So the less that we're using our resources, including our human resources, the less the country is growing wealthier. It's like leaving oil in the ground or leaving coal in the ground or having arable land that you don't grow crops on. You're just letting a useful, productive economic resource lie fallow. And the problem with the Democrats, of course, is they don't actually see American laborers as a productive and useful and valuable economic resource. They see them as mouths to feed, as a problem that has to be solved with a paycheck of some sort, which really implicitly assumes that they have nothing of value to contribute to the economy, which is not only wrong, it's insulting.
So, Kevin, you just laid out in a very articulate manner what the situation really is. How close do you expect either side to actually get to that in this year's campaign or at any time?
How close do I expect them to get to that, understanding that argument?
Yes.
And using it in a campaign?
Yes.
Well, you'd be a fool to use that argument in a campaign. You know, I mean, here are the arguments that work in campaigns. I'm going to give you a tax cut. I'm going to write you a check. I mean, those are basically the ones that work. I hate saying this. The American people are smart. They are productive. They are hardworking. But they're really stupid voters. They've been stupid voters for a long time. And they have, you know, every indication that they're going to continue being stupid voters. Really good at developing software and putting men on the moon and that kind of stuff. Really dumb at democracy.
We'll leave it there. Kevin, always great to chat with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Kevin Williamson of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us. And Jim will be back tomorrow. Please join us then for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great day, everyone.